following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Today we're looking at 1 Samuel chapters 19 and 20. And while you're finding that this morning, I want you to think about a question. Who is the most difficult person you've ever had to deal with? Who is the most difficult person you have ever had to deal with? Now, I may be going out on a limb, but I'm going to guess that for 99% of us, we've never had to worry about a boss trying to run us through with a spear. Maybe you have, I don't know. But for most of us, I don't think that things have gotten to that point. However, we've probably all had to deal with people who were difficult or mean or even what we might call toxic. Okay? Now be cautious about throwing that last word around too freely. Interacting with people is unavoidable. Okay? It's just part of life. And it always carries a risk. And as you've heard me say before, that's because every single one of us is broken in some way. Some are more broken than others, but we all have a level of brokenness. And so as we try to do life together, we rub up against each other and those jagged edges clash and collide. And sometimes it can cause friction, pain, or even some disappointment. And that just goes with being human. Not a one of us is perfect. And if you think you're perfect, I invite you to stand in here after the service because I'm sure there's a long line of people who'd like to disabuse you of that notion. But we're all broken. And for that reason, we all need to learn to extend a little grace and a little forgiveness to each other. However, there are some people who can come across our path who are so broken that they can actually be a little bit dangerous. They tend to kind of poison the well all around them. They kind of leave little pools of chaos in their wake. Another word that gets thrown around a lot is the word narcissist. And again, I caution you against throwing that word around too freely. I think our culture overuses that word sometimes. But I have run into some people in the past, a few, to whom that term certainly applies. And these are people who are always the heroes of their own story, and they don't care about anybody else. Everybody else is just a tool that they can use to get what they want, regardless of the pain or suffering that it may cause somebody else. And there are people who will lie to you and try to manipulate you and intimidate you and bully you to try to get you to do what they want. And I've encountered one or two people over the course of my life that I think actually got a little pleasure out of inflicting pain on other people. We see some of those tendencies in the person of King Saul, Israel's very first king, as he's described for us in the pages of 1 Samuel. We've been studying the life of David, so that means from time to time, because David was the young man that was tapped by God to replace Saul, we've also had to deal with Saul. And so we're going to see today where that relationship went. And I think there's some things we can learn from how David responded to Saul. And he tried to navigate that relationship. Now, again, I want to issue another caution here. One thing we need to be careful about when reading the Old Testament is approaching every story like one of Aesop's fables. Okay? Not every story in the Bible has some great moral or is driving home some theological point. Sometimes these accounts are just telling us, this is what happened. This is the way things went down. That said, the Apostle Paul did write in Romans 15, verse 4, that whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. And so in the case of these two chapters we're looking at today, these were not written explicitly to give us, here's 10 points to deal with narcissists, okay? Nevertheless, David did do some things right as he tried to navigate this relationship. And there's an example here that you and I can learn from. There's some very practical things here. Now, it's a lot of ground to cover. It's two chapters. I know you don't want to be here till tonight. So we're going to try to do that as expeditiously as we can. I'm going to stick pretty close to my notes just to make sure I don't chase any rabbits that lead us too far afield. But there's some good stuff here we can learn from David's example. And first thing is, David accepted intercession from trustworthy friends. Look at chapter 19, starting at verse 1. Now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I'll speak with my father about you. If I find out anything, then I will tell you. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, don't let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial for you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed. Take note of that word there. He vowed, as the Lord lives, he will not be put to death. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. Again, as we've seen time and time again, as Saul's resentment towards David grew, David found himself in a precarious position. Eventually, Saul got to the point of plotting to have David killed. And so Saul's son, Jonathan, sought to warn David. David had to decide whether he could trust Jonathan and accept the help that was offered. For a while at least, Jonathan was able to intercede and convince his father not to harm David. His father actually vowed a solemn vow before the Lord that he wouldn't harm David. Sometimes when we're caught in a toxic relationship, it's very difficult to trust other people. In some cases, a toxic person will intentionally seek to isolate you from other people for the purpose of making it easier to manipulate you. In a situation like that, it's good to know who your real friends are. It's good to know which friends are trustworthy. It's good to know friends who have your best interest at heart. It's friends who are not seeking to use you for their own purposes, but to actually help you. We all need friends who are willing to tell us the truth that we need to hear, even if it's not the truth we want to hear. And I think David had that in Jonathan. If you are blessed to have people like that in your life, don't be afraid to ask them for help. David also came to a point where he had to remove himself from the immediate danger. The reprieve brokered by Jonathan turned out to be very short-lived. Yes, Saul said, as the Lord lives, I'm not going to hurt him. Well, what happened is David continued to win more battles and fame. In verse 8, when there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter, so that they fled before him. And the more that David won, the deeper Saul sank into jealousy and paranoia. Look at verse 9. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. You can almost envision Saul sitting there in the dark in his palace, brooding over David's success and the fact that David was stealing his limelight. Listen, sane men do not sit around holding spears. Okay? The equivalent would be somebody just kind of sitting around holding their rifle, just waiting. You know? Not a healthy situation. For his part, David actually sought to bring relief to Saul. At the end of verse 9, David was playing his harp with his hand. So David is, you know, that's the reason he was brought into Saul's court in the first place, was to play his music to try to soothe the savage beast. So David's trying to help Saul out, and it's something we see throughout David's life. David never went out of his way to cause harm to Saul. David always took the high road. He's attempting to bring relief to Saul, but in a fit of rage, listen to what happens in verse 10. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with a spear. This is the second time that Saul has tried to run David through. We read about the first time last week. So in a fit of rage, Saul attempts to pin David to the wall. So David faced a choice. Should he stick around and take a chance that it was just a fluke, that Saul was trying to turn him into a human pincushion? I mean, well, you know, Saul doesn't try to do that all the time. Maybe I did something to set him off. Yeah, Saul's a great boss when he's not angry. You know, Saul's under a lot of stress. He's faced so much pain in his past. I mean, you can't blame him for being a little touchy. Maybe things will be better if I go out and beat a few more Philistines for him. No one has ever offered me a job like Saul has offered me. If I leave, I'm going to lose everything. If I up and run, what will people think? I just need to man up and tough it out. Those are the kind of excuses people make when they're caught in relationships like this. The other choice facing David was whether he should remove himself from the situation for his own protection. And to his credit, the second part of verse 10, he slipped away from Saul's presence so that he stuck the spear into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. So David decided to leave. In some situations, we may need to leave. And leaving can be as simple as just setting some healthy boundaries. Just saying to the other person, listen, what you're doing to me is not right, and I'm not going to sit by and let you do that anymore. Other times, maybe leaving takes the form of altering your routine so that you limit your exposure to the person who is toxic. But there are some situations where we may need to literally walk away for our own physical or emotional safety, even if that's only temporary. But sometimes we need to do like David, and we need to flee. So what did David do? Well, David sought temporary refuge in his own house. But look, listen what happened, verse 11. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. So Saul sends a hit team to catch David in his own house. And once again, David faced the decision of whether or not to accept help from an unlikely source. Picking up again in verse 11, but Michal, David's wife, said to him, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. David's wife, who remember, who was her daddy? This is Saul's daughter. She knows what her dad's like. And she says, David, I love you, honey. You got to get out of here. If you don't leave tonight, you're not going to be able to leave. I used to tell my kids when we first moved back, and we would go down to where the aquarium's at in downtown Chattanooga, and they would ooh and awe over that aquarium and all the shops and stuff down there. And I used to tell them, guys, when I was in college back in the late 80s, none of this was here. Like, this was a very different part of town. Back when I was in school and I was growing up in Chattanooga, if you were found here at night, you would be found here in the morning. Okay, and that's what McCall's saying to David. Hey, you got to get out of here while the getting's good. And then she encouraged David to flee while she carried out this elaborate ruse to cover his escape in verse 12. So Michal let David down through a window. He went down and fled and escaped. Michal took a household idol or a little statue and laid it on the bed. And there's a lot of debate. We said, why is he doing keeping an idol in his house? We don't know for sure that this was actually a religious statue or what. The word there basically means it's a figurine of some kind. It often gets translated as idol, but it could have just as easily been some kind of memento from something. But she takes it and puts it in the bed and with a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So she makes it like a dummy. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. So she actually fudged the truth a little bit to try to save his life. Whether or not that was justified, we can argue about that, but that's what happened. Then Saul's messengers sent messengers to see David saying, bring him up to me on his bed. If he's sick, just pick him up and bring him on down here. When the messengers entered, and behold, the household idol was on the bed with a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this? And let my enemy go. Now remember, this is also his son-in-law that he's talking about here. Let my enemy go, so he's escaped. And Michal said to Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I put you to death? So again, she tells a little untruth here. He threatened me. So I'm sure that helped. Again, we could have a discussion about whether or not that was the right thing to do or not. It probably caused David, it probably gave her an out, but it caused David even more heartache because now Saul thinks that David is making threats against his children. And we know that didn't happen. So David is on the run. He removes himself from the situation. Now think about this for a second. Okay, as Chuck Swindoll points out in his book on the life of David, in short order and through no fault of his own, David has lost nearly every support that he could lean on in his life. He lost his job. He's lost his best friend, Jonathan. He's lost his wife. He's lost his home. If everything were to be ripped away from you in a night, where would you turn for help? Well, David had one other source left that he could turn to. David sought spiritual guidance. Verse 18. David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. So for the second time in this narrative, we have these words that David fled. David sought out the prophet Samuel at Ramah, which was where Samuel was living in semi-retirement at this time. David poured out to Samuel everything that had happened. You know, sometimes you just need to vent, right? And so Samuel takes David to a place where he could find some refuge. Everybody knew of Samuel's connection to Ramah. So it wouldn't take a rocket scientist for Saul to think of this. Hey, where is David likely to run to? He's probably going to run to Samuel. Where is Samuel at? He's in Ramah. And sure enough, that's what happens here later in the story. So Samuel takes him to this place called Naoth, which is actually part of the greater Ramah metro area. The word Naoth actually means dwellings. And a lot of archaeologists believe that Naoth was this densely packed community of huts and apartments located on the outskirts of Ramah, going where all these old buildings are packed in so tightly. And apparently there was a community of prophets and prophets in training who lived in this confusing warren of structures and buildings. So it'd be easy for David to disappear into that and maybe be able to hide out for a little while. When you're seeking to navigate a toxic relationship, turn to trusted spiritual advisors who can help you seek out God's guidance, to help you figure out what your next step should be. In fact, that should be the first place we turn to. Why is it so often the last one we turn to is God, when he should be the first one we turn to? David relied on God's ability to intervene. And we see that described in verses 19 through 24. Sure enough, Saul's spy network figured out pretty quickly where David was headed. Verse 19, it was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah." So in verse 20, he sends a squad to hunt him down. Saul sent messengers to take David. But when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. So when this hit team gets there, they arrive at the school of the prophets, they're ready to march in and demand for David. Something totally unexpected happens. As they enter this assembly, God's Spirit overwhelms them. Now the details are a little sketchy, but apparently Saul's stooges fell to the ground overcome by some kind of ecstatic experience that rendered them helpless. And they couldn't complete their mission. So Saul sends out another team and another. And the same thing happens to them as well. Verse 21, when it was told Saul, he sent out other messengers, they also prophesied. So Saul sent messengers again the third time, they also prophesied. So he keeps sending these teams out, and the Spirit of God keeps stopping them from doing what they were sent to do. And so finally, Saul says, well, if you got to do something, I guess you got to do it yourself. So he goes to take care of David. Verse 22, then he himself went to Ramah and came as far as the large well that is in Sakeu. And he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, behold, they're in Naoth in Ramah. He proceeded there to Naoth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. So that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naoth in Ramah. He also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay down naked all the day and all that night. Therefore they say, is Saul among the prophets? So Saul marches in there, God's Spirit comes upon him, he starts pulling his clothes off and just babbling like a fool, and he is just, you know, people today talk about being slain in the Spirit. I don't know how biblical that is, but that surely does describe what we're seeing happen to Saul right here. He's just laid out, okay? Word spread. It actually became a proverb throughout Israel. Is Saul among the prophets? Now, a phenomenon like that can only be described as a direct intervention by God. You and I may never face the same kind of dramatic intervention like we see here, but listen to me. Do not discount the fact that God may be at work behind the scenes in ways that you are not aware of. I have seen it happen. You know, and it's not a pleasant thing to have your life suddenly turned upside down, But trust that even in the chaos, God is at work on behalf of those who trust Him. Sometimes things may have to get worse before they can get better. But cling to the promise from Romans chapter 8, verse 28. God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Doesn't say all things will always be good. There's going to be some valleys. There's going to be some setbacks. There's going to be some toxic people in your path. But keep trusting in God. You don't have to fight those fights on your own. You don't have to go through those trials under your own strength. Rely on His strength and trust that He is behind the scenes and He's doing something. He is working things out. And in the end, His perfect plan is going to be fulfilled. In a few minutes, I'm going to tell you about a time when the Lord drove this point home to me. For now, let's continue to look at how David navigated this situation. Number 5, David was prepared to prove his intentions. David took advantage of the confusion at the school of the prophets to escape and to set up a secret rendezvous with Jonathan. In chapter 20, verse 1, then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What's my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he's seeking my life? Hey, Jonathan, didn't this guy promise he was going to leave me alone? You told me that. You told me that everything was cool. And he's still out here trying to kill me. What have I done? What line have I crossed that he's trying to end me?" Even though Jonathan had been one of the first people to warn David about his father, he had trouble believing his own father had gone back on this solemn vow he made to spare David's life. Remember, back in chapter 9, verse 6, what did he say? "As the Lord lives," when you enlist God in on your promise, that's serious business, okay? God takes that very seriously. "With God as my witness," okay, you better follow through because you just invoked God to stand by your side on that. But now Saul has forgotten all that. Was he lying? Did he change his mind? Who knows? But he has gone back on that vow. Because you can't trust toxic people. They will lie and manipulate. In verse 2, Jonathan said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It's not so." Jonathan doesn't believe that his dad is still trying to kill David. So David continues to plead his innocence and his integrity. Verse 3, David vowed again. So here's David making a vow. "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, or he'll be grieved.' But truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." So David convinces Jonathan to go along with the plan that would prove David's blamelessness and bring to the surface Saul's betrayal. In verse 4, then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I'll do it for you." So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon. I ought to sit down and eat with the king, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it's the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says it's good, your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil." So a festival is coming up, which ordinarily, as a member of the royal court and as a member of the king's family, his son-in-law, David would be expected to celebrate this with the king. So David tells Jonathan, "Okay, we're getting ready to have this festival. I'm not going to show up. I'm going to go hide. And if Saul asks about my absence, here's what you do. You tell him that I have gone back to my hometown to celebrate the festival with my own family." And then Saul's response would tell Jonathan everything he needed to know about his father's intentions towards David. David stated his intentions were to remain bound by the covenant that he and Jonathan had made with each other years before. Verse 8, "Therefore deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there's iniquity in me, put me to death yourself." Jonathan, if I've done this, if this is my fault, you end me yourself, okay? If I've done anything wrong, let it fall on me. In essence, David was putting himself at Jonathan's mercy. In later episodes, as we continue looking at David's life, we're going to see that David, despite everything Saul did to him, David continued to respect Saul. And he continued to forgo opportunities when Saul was delivered into his hand, at least two occasions, he's right there and all David has to do is stick the knife home. His men are saying, do it, then we can all go home and this will all be over with. And in both cases, David says, I cannot bring myself to harm the Lord's anointed. So despite everything that Saul did to him, David didn't respect the man, but he respected the position. And he refused to hurt the man who'd been anointed to be king. And so they cook up this scheme, and Jonathan reaffirms his loyalty to David, and they set up a plan for following up after the festival. They set up a code, how Jonathan's going to be able to get word to David. That's what's described in verses 9 through 11, which I'm not going to read. But here's the lesson to this point, okay? Stick to the high ground. When you're dealing with toxic people, don't let them pull you down to their level. You take the high road. I've referred to the book of Romans in the New Testament a couple times already this morning. There's actually a lot of great advice in Romans for how to deal with injustice with integrity. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1, Paul says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, actually, I think it's verse 18, but as possible, as far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Now, it's not always possible, right? You know, you can try to be at peace with people, but there are some people who are going to refuse to be at peace. You take the high road. Take the high road. As far as is possible, be at peace with all men. In verse 19, he goes on to say, never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. There are situations in life where somebody hurts us, and our first inclination is to swing back. Don't do it. Trust in God. Listen, one thing I've learned in my life, you know, God is a lot more creative in the Justice Department than I am. And I've seen situations where, you know, maybe I had every right to strike back at somebody, but I took the high road, I stepped back, and I said, God, they're in your hands now. And then whatever worked out, I'm like, it left me going, wow, I hope, God, you're never upset with me. Because I see how you handle this type of situation. Believe it in the hands of God. Verse 21, Romans chapter 12, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Boy, that's hard. Because everything within us wants to strike back. We're facing situations in our country right now where, you know, I hear a lot, well, they did it first. We ought to do it back to them twice as hard. Hey, if you call yourself a follower of Jesus, you're called to overcome evil, not with evil, but with good. The fact they did it first should not enter into the equation. David was also committed to acting in goodwill. In verses 12 through 17, they had this discussion. Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there's a good feeling towards David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. So he's pledging himself here, hey, if my dad's really out to get you, and I find that out, and I don't tell you, may God punish me like he's going to punish my father. That's what Jonathan is saying there. But stick with it here. It gets really interesting. And may the Lord be with you, in verse 13, as he has been with my father. So he's recognizing here that David has a legitimate claim on the throne. That Saul's star is declining while David's is rising. Who was it that's supposed to be the inheritor of Saul's office? His own son, Jonathan. And he's saying, I realize now God's taken away from my family and he's about to give it to yours. Jonathan has a request he makes of David. In verse 14, if I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Now, here's what's going on. In the ancient Middle East, if you had a situation where there was a change in dynasty, where one family was in charge, and then there was a war, and another family defeated that one and took over, it was customary for the new king to systematically wipe out all the relatives of the old king. Wives, children, aunts, uncles, cousins, whoever was connected to the old regime. Because you didn't want anybody coming back to seek revenge, right? You didn't want any of these people who still may have some sympathy with the populace to be able to start a rebellion against you, right? The people flock into them instead of supporting you. So best way to do that in their eyes, just wipe the board. So Jonathan is saying, David, one of these days God's going to make you king. And when that happens, please have mercy on my family. Please do not wipe us out. And guess what? David responds to Jonathan's plea by making a vow not to seek retribution against his family. Verse 17, Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. And we know from history that David did his best to honor that vow. There were a couple occasions where some of Jonathan's descendants tried to side with the rebels. But wherever possible, David extended mercy to those who survived from Jonathan's family. In dealing with toxic people, always strive to be the bigger person. I know it's hard. We tell our kids that all their life, you know. Always be the bigger person. Boy, they chafed against that. Always strive to be the bigger person. Alexander the Great was known for being extremely brutal towards his enemies, but magnanimous towards those who respected him. And in 326 BC, Alexander led his army against the forces of an Indian king named Porus near the Hydaspes River. It's recorded as probably the closest Alexander ever came to losing a battle. It was fierce. The battle did cost Alexander his favorite horse, the legendary Bucephalus that he'd ridden for so many years, shot out from under him. When Porus finally appeared before Alexander to surrender, everybody's standing around saying, oh my, somebody's getting ready to lose their head. Alexander asked Porus how he wanted to be treated. And Porus looked at Alexander respectfully and said, I want to be treated like a king. In other words, Alexander, I'm hoping you give me a quick, dignified death. Alexander was so impressed by Porus's humility and his regal nature, he not only spared his life, he made him governor back over his people, but this time ruling under Alexander's authority. And Porus served Alexander faithfully the rest of his life. Take the high road. Be the bigger person. Show some magnanimity. That means a large-heartedness towards those who oppose you. David was determined to proceed prudently. Verses 18 through 40. I'm not going to read all this, but it's pretty involved. But Jonathan and David set up this elaborate plan to communicate the results of this test Jonathan was about to administer to his father. The day the festival came, Saul asked Jonathan about David's whereabouts. Isn't that just like a toxic person? They spend weeks trying to kill you, then they expect you to show up for work. When Jonathan shared David's cover story, look at what happened to Saul in verse 30. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. Now I'm not going to tell you what that says in Hebrew, but I think you can figure it out. Do I not know that you're choosing the son of Jesse to be to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Again, this is very profane in the Hebrew. That's how angry Saul was. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. He's still thinking about his legacy. It's going to be your kingdom, Jonathan. You're giving it away to this guy. Therefore, now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father decided to put David to death. Didn't matter what his dad had promised. Don't look at a toxic person's words, look at their actions. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. His dad had made a fool out of him because he made this vow and didn't follow through on it. He had no intentions of following through on it. He accused his own son of conspiring against him. He said nasty things about Jonathan's mother. At this point, Jonathan's eyes were open to the worst about his own father. And I'm telling you, that probably had to be a terrible experience for him. And so using their prearranged signals, Jonathan communicated the bad news to David. Now the lesson here, proceed with caution, okay? Act prudently. As Proverbs 22 verse 3 tells us, the prudent sees the evil and hides himself, while the naive go on and are punished for it. So keep your wits about you when you're dealing with people like this. And be cautious, one step at a time. Make sure you're not being blind to the danger. Keep your eyes open to the reality of the situation. And finally, David was required to trust in God alone. Jump down to verse 41. After the secret message was sent, Jonathan and David come together one last time. When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed each other, which was a sign of showing respect in that culture. And they wept together, but David wept the more. Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" Then he arose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. They reaffirmed their covenant together and their faith in God's plan. David left that place with no support but God alone. He is literally on his own now. And even though he trusted in God's plan, he would be on the run for years until the promise God had made to him came to fruition. No matter how long it takes, keep clinging to God and keep trusting that he is going to bring you through. Now, over the years, I've encountered my share of Sauls. I bet you have too. At times, it's been painful. Sometimes it's been a little scary. However, God's been faithful. Over and over, I have learned the power of the words that Joseph the patriarch spoke to his brothers, those same brothers that sold him into slavery, according to the book of Genesis. In Genesis 50, he finally reveals to them how God had put him into a position over them as, one of the chief administrators of Egypt. They're scared to death that he's getting ready to separate their heads from their shoulders in revenge. And he says, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about the present result." Even when other people betray us, God in his sovereignty can use that to further his plan. One occasion, and I want to be very careful here because I don't want to be the kind of person who's throwing dirt about people, but I was working in an environment that was particularly toxic. Now, God was working in some powerful ways. We were seeing some really cool things happen. A lot of measures, we were seeing success. But there were some people involved in that organization who had their own agendas and were more interested in advancing themselves than in the health of the whole team. And behind the scenes, the atmosphere was incredibly tense. And everybody was walking around on eggshells. You ever been in an environment like that where you're scared of what you might do? No matter what you're going to do, you're going to get criticized. You've been there? That's what it was like. And for my part, I was perhaps a little too loyal, a little too committed. I was a little too stubborn to leave. That's always been one of my flaws, is not knowing when to let go and say that's enough. I passed up on other opportunities to stay at this place because I wanted to see this one through. There were some good things happening. I could put up with some of this garbage behind the scenes because I wanted to see the good stuff, right? I'll never forget the day the boss walked into my office and said, "We've decided to go a different direction. We no longer need you. Collect your stuff and leave." Never saw it coming. One of my former co-workers told me years later there was some politics going on behind the scenes that somebody else wanted my position. And so they had been maneuvering and stabbing me in the back so they could get it. I don't know the truth of that, but that's what I was told years later. Here's something I learned. Everybody needs to be fired once. If nothing else, then learn that it's survivable. But it's also scary. In the blink of an eye, I found myself with no income and no insurance and a wife and two small kids I had to take care of. But let me tell you something. God was at work. This was in the early days of the internet. Some of y'all may remember something called message boards. I'm dating myself. That was before we had Facebook and all that. I belonged to some message boards that served people in that industry. And so I didn't go on there. I didn't trash my employer. I didn't go say, "You won't believe what just happened to me." I just said, "Hey guys, listen, covet your prayers. I'm available. If you've got anything, let me know." That's all I said. That was on Monday. By the same time, Tuesday, I'd already been contacted by six different organizations saying, "Hey, send us your resume." By that Friday, I was in another state interviewing for a job. The person I was interviewing with was somebody that I'd known casually. We'd crossed paths a couple of times, never ever thought about possibility of working with him. I didn't remember much about the actual interview, but there's one thing he said that night as we sat at the steakhouse talking about what he was looking for, said something that just kind of all of a sudden, he said, "I just want you to know, I got one rule in my place. Nobody walks on eggshells." Whoa. And you know what? He was telling the truth. Spent several years with that organization, and it was a place of healing and recovery. And it wasn't always easy, but it was a place where God began to put some pieces back together for us after such a traumatic experience and years of living in that toxicity. Listen, as you pursue God's purpose for your life. Things won't always move in a straight line. You'll encounter some obstacles along the path. Some of those obstacles are going to be people. Some of those are going to be merely difficult. But some may turn out to be truly toxic. You'll be tempted to meet hostility with hostility. Don't fall into that trap. Keep your eyes on God. Stick to the high ground. Don't be afraid to set healthy boundaries or even to remove yourself from certain situations if you need to for your own good. Learn who you can trust and proceed with caution. But always, always, always keep in mind that if God brought you to it, He can bring you through it. Don't give up and keep trusting in Him.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautics.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.